We ended last time by talking about the fact that in translation, we can't have a one-to-one correspondence between RNA nucleotides and amino acids. What was the reason for that? In other words, why can't you have an RNA nucleotide specify an amino acid? Oh, for the latecomers? I asked, why is it that we can't have a one-to-one correspondence between RNA nucleotides and amino acids?
Because RNA nucleotides have 3 and 4
or
something?
You threw some numbers in there. That's part of the answer. But the answer is that there's not enough types of RNA nucleotides to go around, right? You only have 4 to work with. You have to specify 20 amino acids. Mm-hmm. Right? This is how we ended last time. And you can't use a single RNA nucleotide to specify amino acids. You have to have a sequence. And 2 is not enough, because there's only 16 possibilities, right? That's why you need a triplet or 3 RNA nucleotides to specify a single amino acid. And what do we call that triplet in RNA?
A codon.
A codon. Right. There's how many possibilities?
64.
64. 4 cubed, exactly. And so what we're looking at in this slide 4 that opens today is the complete listing of all 64 possible RNA codons. This is the genetic code. And I say stress it as the genetic code rather than a genetic code, because all organisms that have ever existed, well, with a tiny couple of exceptions, effectively all organisms that have ever existed use this same genetic code. This is a universal genetic code. So it's not that we humans use this and sequoia trees use a different code and so on. This is one of the several bits of compelling evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms have a common ancestor. We all descend from that original successful lineage of cells that is the trunk of the entire tree of life. We all use the same genetic code. So in the genetic code, you can see that you see all 64 listings of triplets, which are all caps. Right, UUC, and so on. Those are the codons. Next to each of those, though, is also a three-letter sequence, but not all in caps. Those three-letter strings are just abbreviations for the 20 amino acids, 20 biological amino acids. So phenylalanine, leucine, and so on. You don't have to memorize those. You don't have to memorize the code either, for that matter. But you can see that each individual codon corresponds to a specific amino acid. That's the genetic code. Now, there are 64 codons possible, which are all listed here. But notice that only 61 of them have an amino acid listed next to them. The 3 that are highlighted in orange, or salmon, whatever color that is, do not specify amino acids. They are labeled as stop codons, which is pretty self-explanatory, but I'll say it anyway. A stop codon tells the ribosome, which is the machine that assembles the amino acids to make the polypeptide, but it does so by reading individual codons one at a time, when any of these 3 stop codons is the one that comes up next and is being read currently, that tells the ribosome, you're already done. You've added the last amino acid. This polypeptide is complete. It stops the translation process, in other words, any one of these 3. And so they're different sequences, the 3, but it doesn't matter at all which of the 3 comes up. They all work exactly the same way. Now, of the 61 other ones that specify amino acids, there's one that's special, which is highlighted in green. And that AUG codon does double duty, really. One of its double duty jobs is simply to specify methionine. That's what MET stands for, an amino acid. It specifies methionine, just like all the other codons specify some sort of amino acid. All the other 61, I should say. The second of the double duty aspect of AUG is that it serves as the start codon. So there are three stop codons. Doesn't matter which one is used individually. There's one start codon. But unlike the stop codons that say only stop and they don't specify an amino acid, the start codon tells the ribosome this is the beginning, this is the start of translation, but it also, at the same time, specifies methionine, which means that whatever gene is being used, whatever the mRNA is that got transcribed and whatever is now being translated, each protein, each polypeptide, starts out with methionine as the first amino acid. Because the codon that specifies methionine is also the start codon. Now, it doesn't mean that that methionine amino acid is going to remain in the final product. Because some polypeptides shouldn't have it in there, but it has to be in there to start with simply because of this double duty of the start codon. That means that after translation occurs, polypeptides can be modified. Part of that modification can be to remove that methionine, for instance. All right, now there are two really important aspects of the genetic code that we need to make clear. One is that the genetic code is redundant. And the other is that the genetic code is not ambiguous. So let's talk about these two terms as they're used in everyday language outside of biology. What does it mean to be redundant?
Isn't it like repetitive?
Exactly. Like if you say something is great, big, huge, whatever, you know, that's great, big, and huge all mean the same thing. They mean big. So it's redundant to say that. Or he repeated himself over and over and over and over again. That's a redundant phrase. You don't need all of that information, right? Well, the genetic code, I said, is redundant. And that's simply because 64 is greater than 20. What I mean is that you have 64 codons to work with, but you only have to specify 20 biological amino acids. So you can start using codons, multiple codons, to specify the same amino acid. And you can see that by the brackets here. Like phenylalanine can be specified by either UUU or UUC. Either one of them works. You have more than codons than you need, so you can start doubling up on them, or tripling up, or greater. This is completely analogous in language to synonyms. Like I said, great, big, and huge all mean big. Well, there's plenty of other words that also mean big. They're synonyms, right? You can choose between them. Similarly, you can choose between any of the bracketed sets of codons. Doesn't matter which of those is used, they all will specify the same amino acid. That's redundancy. Now, what about ambiguity? What does it mean to be ambiguous? It is vagueness, but it's a specific kind of vagueness. It's vagueness because there is more than one possible meaning. And you don't know which one was intended by whoever said that thing or wrote that thing. Okay, so vagueness by virtue of there being multiple meanings. And the simple sentence I use as an example for that is, I'm hot, which has at least four meanings that I thought of. You know, it can mean that my body temperature is elevated. It can mean that I'm very angry. It can mean that I'm a currently very popular celebrity. Or it can mean I'm sexually attractive, right? And maybe other things as well. But if all you have is that phrase, you're either hearing someone say that or you're reading that, you don't know which one's intended. That's ambiguity. That would be a bad thing to have in a genetic code. If the genetic code were ambiguous, that would mean, for instance, UUU sometimes specifies phenylalanine, and other times it would specify some other amino acid. The reason that would be terrible is because changing just one amino acid in a polypeptide makes it fold up into three dimensions differently. It has a different shape and therefore doesn't work the same way, if at all. So you have to make sure you get the sequence of amino acids correct. And therefore there is not any ambiguity. You can see that there's not ambiguity because there's no such thing as a single codon corresponding to more than one amino acid. All right? Any questions on all of that? Let's go on then to 5 and look at a couple of unusual organisms, a tobacco plant on the left and a pig on the right. Both of which glow. Now, these aren't just colorized pictures. They're actually glowing organisms. That's unusual for both of these, right? Normal, in the wild, tobacco plants don't glow. Neither do in the wild pigs. Both of these are genetically modified organisms, though. So, they do glow. The whole pig is glowing, by the way. It looks like just the nose and the hooves. But if it were shaven, it would be, the skin would be glowing. You just don't see it because of the hair. Anyway, the question that is pertinent here is, well, before I get to that, they're genetically modified by inserting a gene from some natural organism that naturally glows into this other species. So the glowing tobacco plant got its glowing gene from a firefly that naturally glows, and the pig got it from a jellyfish that naturally glows. But the question is, if the gene is for a firefly, how does the tobacco plant's cells know how to use that information? Why does a gene from a firefly work in a tobacco plant? Why does a gene from a jellyfish work in a pig? Well, yes, the gene is instructions. But why do the instructions work in a different kind of organism from what the instructions were taken from? Exactly. It's because of the universality of the genetic code. It's the genetic code. So we can insert genes into other organisms. This is the major way, for instance, nowadays that insulin is produced for human diabetics. We used to have to slaughter hogs. Well, we slaughtered them because people ate them anyway, but we would get from the pancreas of the hogs insulin that was close enough to human versions that most people could use it, but it's not exact. It doesn't work quite as well, and it causes some problems in some people. Plus, there's just a limit to how many hogs you can slaughter. Well, nowadays, we just make as much as we want, because we have genetically modified bacteria with the gene for human insulin. All you have to do is feed the bacteria, which is easy, and they'll produce as much insulin as you want. Not really. Not nowadays. Not now that the whole process of inserting genes has been figured out and industrialized, basically. It's like a pharmaceutical. Well, that's because of the insane policy of having for-profit healthcare and pharmaceutical industries in this country, which is, I could talk about for 3 hours, but we don't have 3 hours. Now, it doesn't have to be expensive is the answer. It is because of profit. Okay, let's go to 6. We're now looking at the particulars of the first part of gene expression. The first part of gene expression is transcription, right? That's the part in which DNA is directly involved. So we've talked about what transcription is before. Now we actually see the details of it. And on the left edge, you can see that transcription as a process consists of three major steps. Initiation first, then elongation, then termination. And initiation, of course, comes first. It means to start out, right? Well, above the word initiation there, you have a double-stranded piece of DNA. We're not making new DNA, right? This is not DNA replication. That was last chapter. This is transcription. So first of all, we're not making DNA. We're making RNA, specifically messenger RNA. And also, we're not using the entire length of the DNA. It's not the whole chromosome that we're using, right? It's just a gene, just a sequence within that overall length for transcription. Also, unlike replication, transcription uses only one of those two strands. In replication, both strands were important because you had to make a copy of each of them. Well, in transcription, only one of the two strands gets read. I said this last time. That's called the template strand. The other strand is meaningless as far as transcription is concerned. It just needs to be gotten out of the way and temporarily ignored during the transcription of the gene. So initiation involves recognizing the gene, because the gene itself is just a sequence of nucleotides, right? It's not structurally evident. You can't tell you're looking at a gene. It's all just A's, T's, C's, and G's the entire length. But each gene has a sequence at the beginning of the overall gene called the promoter, which, because of that specific sequence, tells the cell this is the beginning of the gene. And so the promoter, which is this seafoam color, plus the transcription unit in blue, dark blue, together make up the gene. The promoter is just the beginning of the gene, basically. And initiation requires the cell to have this special enzyme, look in gray, looking like an egg, kind of, called RNA polymerase, to recognize that promoter and bind to the DNA at that promoter site. And only if that happens will transcription occur. The binding of the RNA polymerase to the promoter then allows elongation to happen, the next part. The beginning of elongation, though, involves separation of the two strands in that region. Just like for DNA replication, DNA's other job, transcription requires separation of the two strands, because that's the only way you can read the sequence on either strand, right? So we need to separate the template strand from the non-template strand, and RNA polymerase does that as well. But the non-template strand is simply just gotten out of the way. It's ignored. The template strand, on the other hand, is the one that gets read one nucleotide at a time by the RNA polymerase molecule or enzyme. And by using the rules of complementarity, the correct kind of RNA nucleotide gets laid down one nucleotide at a time. Now, I keep comparing this process to replication. Let's go back to replication and remember that there was a complication with replication, because we were trying to make a DNA, but we couldn't start out with DNA, right? You can only add DNA nucleotides to a sequence that's already there. It can't be the first nucleotide you lay down, which is why in replication you had to start with an RNA primer, remember? which then had to be eventually replaced. Well, you don't have that complication here because you're trying to build RNA, not DNA. So you don't need anything called a primer. You simply lay down RNA nucleotides one at a time right from the start that are complementary to the sequence of DNA nucleotides that are being read by the polymerase molecule on the template strand. Elongation is just that occurring over and over. It's called elongation, of course, because the RNA that's being built is getting longer and longer by one nucleotide at a time. But it happens for some amount of nucleotides. It's not a constant number because genes are different lengths. Why are genes different lengths from each other? Why are there different sized genes? Well, it could be a different code and be the same size. For instance, all 10-digit numbers are the same size, but they're different codes. Anyone else? That's true, but that doesn't answer the question. Well, what is a gene for? How is it arranged? Well, back to what is it for? Not directly. What directly gives you your traits? And how is the gene involved? Okay, why are there different lengths of genes? There are different lengths of polypeptides. Right? However long a polypeptide is, how many amino acids it's made out of, tells you how many codons is required in the DNA and the RNA to specify those amino acids. So elongation happens simply over and over until you get to the end of the gene, however big the gene is. Okay, then that brings up termination, which obviously is at the end. That simply consists of a dissociation of these three major things: the DNA, the RNA polymerase, and the mRNA transcript that has just been built. They all separate from each other. Plus, when the polymerase is no longer there on the DNA, the two strands simply seal back together nicely because nothing's changed in the DNA. It's still complementary to, each strand is complementary to the other, and they will go right back to forming hydrogen bonds like they were originally. Now, this is more or less the complete process in a prokaryote. What I mean by that is that in a prokaryote, a prokaryotic cell, this it happens just as I've said it. There's some complication, though, or some added complexity when it comes to how transcription happens in a eukaryotic cell, and that's addressed in slide 7. So you still have a promoter, which is a sequence telling the cell where the beginning of the gene is. And you still have to have RNA polymerase bind to that promoter in order to activate that gene, to transcribe it. But before that can happen, before the RNA polymerase can bind to the promoter, there also already have to be some number of other kinds of proteins besides the enzyme that bind to that promoter region first. And those things are called transcription factors. This is another use of the word factor to refer to a protein of some sort doing a specific job in a cell. These proteins are called transcription factors because they affect whether or not transcription can happen for that particular gene. If all you have is the RNA polymerase and the promoter, it's not going to be able to bind. It needs the help of those transcription factors. And it can be quite a few transcription factors different from each other, as you can see in this cartoon example. Now, this definitely is added complexity, but with this added complexity comes much greater control over whether genes get turned on or off. Each individual transcription factor can be thought of as a switch. And so to turn a gene on, meaning to make it so that it can be transcribed, you have to throw all of the switches, not just some of them. And if all the switches have been thrown, in other words, if all the transcription factors are present, then finally this RNA transcript, which itself is kind of like the last switch, can bind to the promoter and get it going. But let's think about these transcription factors. I said they are proteins. Where do they come from? Right. All proteins come from information that's in genes originally. No cell knows how to make any protein. That's why you don't glow. Your body only is able to make proteins that the DNA tells it how to make. So these are proteins, and so is the enzyme for that matter. It's a protein. All proteins need to be specified by a protein coding gene somewhere. So you have other genes whose job it is to code for making each individual transcription factor. So there's some genes making the transcription factors, right? And then the job of those proteins, those factors, are to then affect whether or not still other genes get turned on or off. So it's a complex situation, but it allows for exquisite control over whether or not the genes get turned on or off. Let's go on to 8 and look at this piece of eukaryotic RNA, messenger RNA. Now, I know this is eukaryotic because it has undergone a change from what was first created by transcription. A prokaryotic cell, remember, has only one compartment. And so transcription and translation occur in that same compartment. And also, the mRNA that a prokaryotic cell produces is ready to go right away. It doesn't have to be modified after transcription before it can be translated. But a eukaryotic cell has to modify its mRNA after transcription has created that mRNA. And we call those changes that are made post-transcriptional modifications, because they're after transcription happens. This is why we give a special name to the mRNA that gets created right off of the transcription assembly line. In a eukaryotic cell, we call that pre-mRNA, indicating that it is not the final version yet. That pre-mRNA then undergoes post-transcriptional modification in a couple major ways, one of which is shown here. One major post-transcriptional modification is to add these yellow parts that aren't there originally. The pre-mRNA doesn't have these yellow parts at first. So on one end, the 5' end, you have a 5' cap. At the 3' end, you have a poly A tail that needs to be added. It's basically just an adenine over and over. These allow the messenger RNA transcript, which is what we call the whole RNA molecule, to interact with the proteins that make up the tunnels, the nuclear pores, the holes in the nuclear envelope, that will allow this transcript to get out of the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, which is where translation takes place. Don't have that complication in a prokaryotic cell, right? But you do in a eukaryotic cell. So that's part of the post-transcriptional modification. Also notice in this picture, though, that the red region, which was there all along, right, you know, that's produced in transcription before the yellow was added. Not all of that red region consists of codons. Not all of it is going to be used to specify amino acids, in other words. So remember back to the genetic code. There's, it has to be a start codon telling the ribosome, which is going to read this messenger RNA, where to start reading codons. Well, before you even get to the start codon, there is a sequence called the 5' UTR, which just stands for untranslated region. And then after the stop codon, whichever of the three it's using in this RNA, you also have an untranslated region after that, the 3' untranslated region. All right, that's not, that's still not the final product, though, because there's another major kind of modification that has to take place post-transcriptionally. Slide 9 shows you that. So this is still a pre-mRNA, even though it has the yellow ends, because not all the modifications are yet done. But it's already different from what came off of the transcription machine. Notice, though, that the red region includes things that are labeled as exons and things that are labeled as introns. It's all parts of the sequence of nucleotides. But exons get their name because the X part of that is short for expression, meaning they are going to be codons. I shouldn't say that exons are individually going to be codons. Exons are parts of the sequence that are going to be in the final product and therefore stand as codons. They're going to be expressed. Introns get their name because the INT is short for intervening sequences, meaning sequences of nucleotides that occur between the exons. And they are not going to be expressed because they're going to be actually excised or cut out as part of this post-transcriptional modification. This is why the final product, the mature mRNA, or just mRNA, which is ready to go for translation, is now shorter than the pre-mRNA. Even though you've added the tails, it's still shorter because you've taken these introns out and you've sewn together the adjacent pairs of exons. That happens in eukaryotic mRNA, but not prokaryotic. Okay, 10. Let's look at the machinery that accomplishes this editing, which is what removal of the introns is, really. It's editing the mRNA sequence. Just like editing a film takes certain frames of the film out, leaves them out, you don't ever see it in the final version. There's a molecular machine dedicated to doing this job. It's called a spliceosome, but it's made up of smaller parts called SNRNPs, as you see here, which is short for small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. Biologists call them SNRPs, but an RNP, a ribonucleoprotein, think about what that means. This is a complex of macromolecules. Remember, we talked about chromatin being a mixture of protein and DNA? Here we're talking about a mixture of protein and RNA. And the specific kind of RNA in a SNRP is small nuclear RNA, which is what the SN part of it stands for. Now, where does SNRNA come from? Which is just one of many kinds of RNA. We've talked about messenger RNA already, and we still are talking about it. SNRNA is a different kind of RNA. Where does it come from?
DNA?
Yes. DNA is involved. Where did we say the proteins come from? Genes. but specifically protein coding genes. Remember when I was talking about why the phrase one gene, one enzyme hypothesis is incorrect for various reasons? It was then that I introduced you to the concept of there being protein coding genes, which is most of your genes, and then also non-protein coding genes. Protein coding genes, well, all genes get transcribed. Protein coding genes get transcribed to produce messenger RNA, which then goes on into the making a protein process, translation. But in terms of what the DNA does, a protein coding gene stands for how to build a messenger RNA molecule. The non-protein coding genes also get transcribed. They just get transcribed into some other kind of RNA. So there are genes telling the cell how to build each kind of snRNA and all the other kinds of RNA that we're going to talk about. Anyway, when you complex together a small nuclear RNA and a protein, you make a SNRP. And when you complex several SNRPs together with still other proteins, you make this very complex molecule, which is a molecular machine called a spliceosome, which literally means splicing body. The "some" part means body. And what the spliceosome does is this editing. It splices, or I mean, it cuts out the introns by recognizing where an exon ends and an intron begins, and where that intron ends and the next exon begins. And it cuts the RNA transcript at those boundaries between exons and introns. And we can see here that this intron has already been cut out. Now, for the gene expression process that we're in the middle of, this is now worthless. An intron is not going to be used in this process anymore. It's not entirely worthless material, though, right? It's a sequence of nucleotides, and it can be broken apart into individual RNA nucleotides, which then can be recycled. But it's done. It's not going to code for anything as far as making a protein is concerned. Once you have the introns cut out, the exons then also by the spliceosome get connected together end-to-end to form the overall final mature messenger RNA, which is ready to go to translation. This occurs only in eukaryotic cells, like I was saying. It's part of post-transcriptional modification. Okay, 11. At the top, you have a representation of a single gene. It doesn't matter how many exons or introns. It just happens to have three exons, two introns. But the point here is that the introns will be removed. The exons are actually what get expressed. And also, by the way, as I just told you in the previous slide, exons really are part of the RNA, not the DNA. Just like codons are part of RNA, not DNA. But we can still use the word codon to refer to the corresponding part in the DNA, and we can still use exon to refer to the corresponding part of the DNA, because it starts with DNA. But anyway, what you see here by the color coding is that exons individually correspond to just part of the final polypeptide product. The bottom here is the complete polypeptide as after it's been translated, created by translation. And the three colored parts are just part of the overall polypeptide, but they correspond individually to exons. And those parts, each color-coded, are called domains. So if any given polypeptide has a specific set of domains that making up its whole. Well, domains are very similar to functional groups. If you think back to functional groups, the ones we learned in here, or any functional group, it's not an entire molecule, right? It's just part of a larger organic molecule. But that functional group is a specific collection of atoms that, if it's there, if it's part of the molecule, will give the overall molecule specific chemical properties and therefore functions. Similarly, a given domain has a certain shape, which is part of the overall shape of the polypeptide, and will therefore give that overall polypeptide properties and functions. All right, that's 11. Let's go to 12. Transcription is done. Now it's time to, and the post-transcriptional modification as it occurs in eukaryotic cells is done. We're done talking about it. Now it's time to actually use that messenger RNA as a code for how to build a specific polypeptide, one amino acid at a time. That involves another molecular machine called a ribosome, which is an organelle, but remember, it's not a membrane-bounded organelle, which is why you have them even in prokaryotes. Much smaller than a typical organelle. It's a molecular machine, though. And we've already talked about two kinds of RNA, messenger RNA and small nuclear RNA. There's many other kinds of RNA as well. We're not going to get through the whole list in this course. But there are still a couple major kinds of RNA that we haven't talked about that are involved in translation. Some of which makes up part of the stuff of a ribosome. A ribosome is made up of two subunits, small subunit and large subunit. But the stuff making up the subunits is a mixture of RNA and protein. Kind of like in a snurp, except the RNA that's part of a snurp is specifically small nuclear RNA, whereas the RNA in a ribosome is specifically called ribosomal RNA, or rRNA, small lowercase r. That's not labeled here, but rRNA plus protein together make up the brown subunits of the ribosome. And back when we first talked about ribosomes in the tour of the cell chapter, I told you at the time that the picture was a lie because it showed both subunits together with nothing else there. That's because a ribosome doesn't come together, the two subunits don't come together until a messenger RNA has already connected to the small subunit. Then the large subunit comes along and kind of clamps the RNA between the two subunits. Kind of like film is clamped in a projector, and you're going to read that film one frame at a time. Well, you're going to read this messenger RNA one codon at a time as it gets reeled through the ribosome between the subunits. Also, remember that the ribosomal subunits are modular. So this particular small subunit might never see this particular large subunit ever again. Any small subunit can be combined with any large subunit. They're interchangeable. Okay, so that's three kinds of RNA we've already talked about. But there's still another one that's important into this, which is tRNA, which is short for transfer RNA. And transfer RNA gets its name because its job is to transfer one at a time an amino acid to a growing polypeptide that's being built. Now, any individual tRNA can be categorized based on what it is carrying, if anything. So there are two major categories, first of all, of tRNA, which is charged and uncharged. It has nothing to do with electrical charge. A charged tRNA is simply an RNA that is connected directly to an amino acid. It's carrying an amino acid. an uncharged one is not carrying anything. So in this cartoon, notice this tRNA that is just leaving this slot. There's three grooves or slots on the large ribosomal subunit. And this tRNA right here was just previously in this leftmost slot, and it's coming out of it. But notice it's not connected to any amino acid. It's just empty, basically. That's an uncharged tRNA. So that's one major category. This one on the right, which is coming into the rightmost slot, is carrying an amino acid. So it's a charged tRNA. The one in the middle is also charged. It's connected directly to an amino acid, right? But notice the difference between these two charged amino acids. One is carrying exactly one amino acid. The other one is carrying a string of some number two or greater of amino acids. And that's why a charged tRNA can be further distinguished into or broken down into two categories. If a tRNA is carrying exactly one amino acid, then it's called an aminoacyl tRNA. Aminoacyl referring to a single amino acid. If it is carrying a sequence of amino acids, now it's only directly connected to one, as you see here in the middle. But if it's connected to an amino acid that is part of a sequence, either two or more amino acids, then what it really is carrying is not a single amino acid, but a peptide, right? A peptide is a sequence of amino acids, two or more. And so that kind of tRNA will be called a peptidyl tRNA. Is all that clear? Okay. Now, these are not, these names, uncharged, charged, aminoacyl, or peptidyl tRNA, they're not absolute, or they're not permanent. What I mean by that is that any given individual tRNA molecule goes through all three phases, basically. It spends some of its time uncharged, some of its time as an aminoacyl tRNA, and some of its time as a peptidyl tRNA. Just depends where it is in the process. And actually what we'll see happen, but I'll just show you while we're on this figure, this one carrying glycine, which is at the moment an aminoacyl tRNA, it's coming into this first slot, it's actually going to get transferred to it all of this sequence that's being carried by this one. So the phenylalanine, tryptophan, and so on, that's going to be hooked onto this glycine that it's already carrying. And when that happens, this currently aminoacyl tRNA is going to turn into a peptidyl tRNA. And then when it passes that whole sequence off to another one that's coming in, it's going to be empty, just like this one is, and that's going to turn it into an uncharged tRNA. So it just depends on where it is in the process. Okay, well, let's go to 13 and talk about our tRNA structure. Remember that just in general, DNAs are double-stranded and RNAs are single-stranded. There are some exceptions to that, but a typical RNA, including tRNA, is a single strand, a single polynucleotide, one sequence, with a 3' end and a 5' end, as you'd expect. If you take a tRNA and flatten it out, so it loses this three-dimensional structure, you just flatten it out onto a plane, you get the picture that's on the top here. You can see that it's one strand, but that strand folds back on itself. So it looks like there are regions that are two-stranded, but it's really the same strand folding back. And there are three hairpin loops that it makes, giving the overall tRNA a so-called cloverleaf appearance, like the three leaves of a cloverleaf.
or the three leaflets of a clover leaf.
Two of those hairpin loops are not so interesting to what we're talking about here. The middle one, though, is, which is at the bottom of this cartoon at the top of the slide. The whole thing is a sequence of nucleotides because it's an RNA, right? But we don't care about almost all of the sequence. There's one little piece of sequence that we care about, which is a triplet, a sequence of three RNA nucleotides that are in this middle hairpin loop at one end of the molecule. And that particular three nucleotide sequence is called this tRNA's anticodon. Why is it called an anticodon? Because it is complementary to a sequence of three nucleotides in the messenger RNA that we already know is called a codon. And you can tell by the rules of complementarity what codon would correspond to this anticodon, right? So just as there are different codons, there are different tRNA molecules. They're not all just copies of the same molecule. Each individual kind of tRNA has its own specific anticodon that corresponds to a specific codon in the messenger RNA. At the other end of the molecule are both of the ends of the RNA, the 3' end and the 5' end, because it folds back on itself. So both ends are at one end of the overall molecule structurally. And the 3' end is particularly important for the job of transfer RNA, which is to carry amino acids. Remember, we say that it's charged if it is carrying an amino acid. Well, it gets charged by making a connection at its 3' end to an amino acid. The 3' end is what carries it, basically, the amino acid. But any individual tRNA, of course there are millions of tRNAs in a cell, but any individual tRNA molecule is only ever allowed to carry one type of amino acid. The particular type of amino acid that this particular tRNA is allowed to carry, if it's carrying anything at its 3' end, is the one that is specified in the genetic code, the amino acid that's specified in the genetic code by the codon that is complementary to this tRNA's anticodon. Did you get that sentence? You see what I'm saying here? There's a correspondence in the genetic code between a codon, which is mRNA, and amino acid, right? There's a correspondence because of complementarity between a codon in mRNA and an anticodon in a tRNA. So to keep the non-ambiguity, to make sure, in other words, that the correct kind of amino acid is going to be added next, there has to be a correspondence between the anticodon of that tRNA, the codon of the mRNA, and the amino acid that this tRNA is allowed to carry. Because if this tRNA were allowed to carry multiple different kinds of amino acid, you would lose that information. That would be ambiguity, right? When a codon comes up in the mRNA and an anticodon corresponds to it, meaning that tRNA is allowed in, it better be carrying the amino acid that codon corresponds to in the genetic code. Otherwise, you're going to be adding the wrong amino acid to the polypeptide, and it's not going to be the right protein product. Are you getting this? So that's what maintains the integrity of the information. What this means is that there's all kinds of different tRNAs. Each individual tRNA has its own anticodon and therefore can carry only one kind of amino acid. If you don't force this thing into two dimensions and flatten it out, then it has a three-dimensional shape that's kind of like what's in the lower left part of the cartoon. And an even more stylized version is to simply represent it as a bent cylinder. Now, no real detail is shown in this bent cylinder, but that's because, and no sequence information is given in that, but we don't care about that sequence. We only care about the anticodon, which is why only three nucleotides are shown of the many that are actually here. So, just to put it another way, what I'm saying about this maintenance of the information is that if you looked up this particular, I mean, if you write down the sequence that's complementary to this anticodon, which you can do just by the rules of complementarity, and then you look up that codon in the genetic code, that will tell you what kind of amino acid is the only kind of amino acid that this particular tRNA is allowed to carry ever. All right, well, let's go to 14 then and see how the charging of a tRNA occurs. Starting with an uncharged tRNA, how is it that it gets its particular amino acid that it's allowed to carry connected to its 3' end? Well, just like any chemical reaction occurring in a cell, that's going to require the help of a specific enzyme. And just like there are multiple kinds of tRNA corresponding to the different kinds of amino acids, there also are different versions of this enzyme that we're looking at here. There's not just one master enzyme that can work, that can charge all the different kinds of tRNA. Each different kind of tRNA has its own kind of enzyme doing this job. But the enzyme category is called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. It is a synthetase because it functions to synthesize two things. To synthesize means to bring together. Syn means together. And so the two things that are brought together are the two substrates for this enzyme, which are the uncharged tRNA and the particular kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. You bring those together, you are making that bond between the amino acid and the 3' end of the tRNA. That's another way of saying that you're charging that tRNA. And when you hook a single amino acid onto an uncharged tRNA, not only does it become charged, but it specifically becomes an aminoacyl tRNA, right? Because it's carrying just one amino acid. That's why the enzyme is called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. And so the enzyme itself is this gray thing that's shaped kind of like a human embryo. But it's an enzyme with an elaborate active site that fits both substrates. One substrate is the particular amino acid, and only that kind of amino acid will fit into this one, importantly. And the rest of the active site fits in just the right kind of tRNA that's allowed to carry that kind of amino acid. It just brings them together. And once it's charged, the aminoacyl tRNA ejects. And as you would expect, the enzyme is left unmodified, so it can do the same thing. But once again, only with that particular kind of amino acid and tRNA. And when all the different kinds of aminoacyl tRNA synthetases are working to charge all of the kinds of tRNA with their right kinds of amino acids, you just have a pool of all kinds of charged aminoacyl tRNAs in the cell at all times that are just ready to go for translation, basically. They're just waiting their turn. And what I mean by their turn is when the codon that is complementary to their anticodon comes up and gets read by the ribosome next, that's their turn. And that's when they'll be allowed into the ribosome bringing just the right kind of amino acid in to be added to the growing strand that will become the final polypeptide. Is that all clear? In that case, I'll end it there for today. We'll finish up the chapter next time, just for the time for the test.